And 8:09, and on the phone with us now, we've got Charlie Sturgis. Good morning to you, Charlie, from Mountain Trails.
Good morning, Leslie. Let me start with a few congratulations. Let me just congratulate Katie Wright and her fine years of service, 13 years with the Park City Community Foundation, and I certainly wish her the best. She's leading the nonprofit world for us. It's been great. Also, congratulations to Park City Mountains Resort for getting open. That's pretty exciting to have real snow and have some terrain open for the opening day. Also, Leslie, I will get to serious trail stuff here in a moment. I think just if the public didn't know, but a little congratulations to Summit Lands, Youth Sports Alliance, and Mountain Trails. We've all actually at this point moved out of our Club Med location over there on the arts and cultural area and have found new homes. So we're all hunkering down in new places. So if you go to find us at a physical location, please check before you go hunting around. We're not where we used to be. So that being said, you know, we were very, very lucky to get by with no mud season, you know, a couple of weeks ago, 2 weeks ago now. And I think we're going to have to suck it up and have a couple of mud days here. So what we really are asking is get out there and ride on trails, ride or run on trails before they defrost. They just get slimy. Actually, your bike's going to get super dirty and it's going to be more difficult to clean. So just be really cognizant of that. And I know, like for myself today, I'm just planning on going out on a ride on all our bike paths, which are in great shape. And you still can get an hour or two of riding in and basically wait for the skiing to come back. That's very short moment we had there, 3 or 4 days of skiing. So give it a try, hopefully in a few days. Anyways, just that would be it. And hopefully winter will be back here next week and we'll be able to put our bikes away and go cross-country skiing.
Okay. Thanks, Charlie. Stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be talking with the Vice President of Development of PEG Companies, Robert Schmidt. We'll be talking a little bit about their presentation to the Park City Planning Commission earlier this week. Park City Mayor Andy Bierman with a recap of last night's meeting. And then finally, National Ability Center Development Director Carrie Cusimano has details on those who were named heroes as part of the NAC's annual Salute Your Hero event. The Park City Planning Commission had just one item on their agenda Wednesday, PEG Company's application to develop the base of the Park City Mountain Resort's parking lots. On the phone is Robert Schmidt. He serves as Vice President of Development for PEG. Good morning to you, Robert.
Good morning, Leslie.
Thanks for being with us. So you focused on architecture, building setbacks, and building heights on Wednesday. The main sticking point of the meeting was just how much of the 1998 MPD agreement is in play here. There was discussion among the Planning Commission about this and PEG's proposals, use of elements of the 98 MPD and then not others. And it sounds like the Commission understands that it's a bit of both. The 1998 agreement must be adhered to unless there's an exception to be made within the current code. So what's your understanding of what's happening here?
Yeah, you know, we felt like the meeting was very productive, and we did feel like there was some understanding of that premise. You know, what we're asking for is that the development agreement with the density and the allowable square footage, you know, that we be allowed to proceed under those terms. However, we are changing the site plan. You know, there are some things that we feel aren't as viable, you know, the way the 98 plan proposed them. And so, you know, we're proposing some changes that we think are improvements, and we're asking that the Planning Commission approve this new plan, you know, under their purview to do so. So, you know, that's our request, and I think we had some good understanding the other night.
The Responsible Resort Area Development Community Group is saying that PEG, I guess accusing you of cherry-picking, as they put it, the original MPD by picking out the elements that you like and disregarding ones that you don't. Do you think that's accurate?
No, you know, we've been very clear from the beginning that we're proposing a new plan here. And, you know, we're asking the commission to evaluate it on its merits, and we believe they have the ability and the right to review our plan, review it on its merits and its compliance with the current LMC. Under the the requirements of the development agreement, which really, you know, is a matter of density and square footage, you know, under the development agreement. So, you know, we've never, you know, said, look, we're going to cherry pick certain elements of it. We've said we're proposing something that's new. It's different. We recognize that. And, you know, we're going to show how it complies with LMC and ask the commission to make a determination if it does indeed meet the requirements of the LMC.
All right. Just so I understand this then, I mean, so doesn't a new plan then require an entirely new development agreement?
Well, that's the premise of our application was that we are amending the development agreement by replacing the site plan. So it's a new site plan, but the development agreement, you know, stays in effect and the rights of the development agreement remain.
All right. And that's still to be decided on then by the Planning Commission then, huh?
Yeah, that will be the, you know, the decision that they make ultimately is, you know, does this new plan comply with the requirements of the development agreement? Does it comply with the changes that we've made? Do they comply with the requirements of the LMC?
All right. You stressed that the designs and the presentation were very preliminary. You said there's still a long way to go before the designs are final. How much wiggle room is PEG willing to give on some of the issues like setbacks and building heights?
That's a great question. Certainly, we're looking for ways to make adjustments where possible, you know, to address concerns. You know, we've requested two exceptions under the LMC. One is building height. The building height request stems from the fact that the density from up on the mountain was transferred in 1998 to the base. And so the height is something that's very important. You know, it was there was an analogy made in August to that of squeezing a balloon. You know, that we've got a certain amount of stuff that needs to fit here at the base, and the way to do that is some height, you know, above the current code or above the current zone requirements in that area, and that was recognized in 1998. That's very important to us. That's a critical element. You know, the setback exception that we requested, we feel that the exceptions that we have requested really provide an improvement to our ability to provide architectural variation and interest and a beautiful building. There is a way, I suppose, that we could meet the letter of the LMC at a 25-foot setback and the requirements of the architectural variation as required in the LMC, but it would be a toned down, not as interesting version of a facade. And so, you know, on that issue, there's probably ways to get around the, you know, the setback requirements, but you know, what we're proposing is really a variation. If you look at our plans on upper floors, we're set back far more than 25 feet. That helps us reduce the perceived scale of the building. You know, the letter of the law is 25 feet. And if we were just a flat 25 feet vertical wall, that would increase the perceived scale of that wall. So we think we're asking for something that's reasonable. You know, it's up to the Planning Commission to determine if, in fact, that is something that they feel is necessary.
So how high are you proposing with your height exception?
So the height exception, we have portions of the building that are, you know, at the highest point, 80 to 85 feet. And that's in line with what was granted in 1998. And then we have other sections of the building that are, you know, 50 to 60 feet, again, in line with what was granted in 1998. So we don't feel that we're out of line in the request that we're making.
Parcel B, this centerpiece of the discussion this week because of its central location and proximity to the surrounding residential areas, especially along Empire and Silver Creek Drive. And the block drawings that you see a lot make it look like this huge white wall just feet away from these existing properties. And again, that's just showing kind of the massing. There's no architectural design or anything like that. But Planning Commissioner John Kenworthy did bring up the need to protect these existing neighborhoods. Are you confident that you can compromise with locals who don't want their views of the mountain gone? I mean, it looks like they're going to be, the drawings I was looking at look like a big white wall in front of them.
Yeah, I think I don't know exactly what you're looking at. We have recently, you know, in August, we presented some architectural versions of the building B, and then again the other night we presented some revisions to that plan where we're showing townhouses along Empire Avenue, and we presented some fairly informative architectural detail along that. So I think, you know, the white wall was a criticism we received of our massings early on in the process. Mm-hmm. You know, those drawings have been certainly updated since, but you know, we have responded to some concerns and comments about, you know, relative scale to houses along Empire Avenue, and in response to that, we added townhouses. You know, we heard concerns about building E along Silver King, and we reduced portions of that building and stepped away from the neighboring Snowflower condominiums. And so we have made an attempt to address concerns and be responsive and you know, address those issues that were raised.
You did present in your presentation a status update on some of the issues that have been presented, and the Building B, there's nothing in that action line item. So does that mean that we're not making changes? We're not?
No, we did make changes from August to, from our meeting in August to November, we made significant changes. Like I said, we added townhouses along Empire Avenue. We reduced an entire floor off of the building that fronts Shadow Ridge and down at the intersection of Empire. And we took a whole floor off of that building and moved it over onto Lowell Avenue. So, you know, we made pretty major changes from our proposal in August. So,
okay, so that's completed under the current status in action then.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Let's talk about the parking garages. Again, it's difficult to understand this. I mean, are they underground or are they just below the buildings? The concept drawings look like it's almost a combination of both because of the grading of the land. Can you tell us, give us more on this?
Yeah. You know, it's so on parcels C and E, the parking is entirely below grade. On parcel B, the parking is partially below grade, and it's kind of like a wedge because at the very northeast corner of the parcel, our parking structure elevation, the first floor, is at about the same elevation as the intersection of Empire and Shadow Ridge, you know, plus or minus. And if you can imagine then just taking kind of a flat plate and sliding it all the way to the southwest corner, by the time you get to the southwest corner, we're three levels below grade. So it's you know, because of the slope of the grade, we're partially below grade, we're partially above grade.
Okay. Would it make, I guess, what would make going deeper for parking to reduce that building height worth it?
Well, there's a lot of considerations regarding that. One certainly is schedule and timing, and the other is you know, there's a cost element to going deeper that gets more complicated. The construction itself gets more complicated. The shoring gets more complicated. Dewatering gets more complicated. There's a lot of factors that affect the ability to go deeper. So, you know, at three levels below grade on that upper side, that's pretty extensive and presents challenges to going deeper.
And will all of the parking now be paid parking?
Yeah. 1998 anticipated that, you know, with the new parking structures, that parking would be paid. And, you know, that's going to be similar for us. Constructing these parking structures will require that parking be paid.
So the buses are going to be very important, at least for locals here. Does the bus drop-off area stay as it is today, or does that get some kind of an improvement?
We agree that bus access is critical, and very important for the success of the resort, the entire base area. And so certainly improvements need to be made, and we're working with staff to figure out the best way to do that. You know, how do we increase bus circulation? How do we increase the number of bus bays available? How do we make the arrival experience for people on transit a better experience? And there's lots of people that have an interest in that and that need to participate in that. So, you know, those parties are engaged, and we're working through the best way to do that.
All right. Does the concern over needing some golf course property, it sounds like we're not talking about a traffic signal rather than a roundabout, so you wouldn't need to encroach on the golf course?
Yeah, we heard the concern from folks in the community and certainly the city that there wasn't much appetite to give up any city property to accommodate a roundabout. We went back to the drawing boards and looked at other ways to deal with that intersection. Our traffic engineers looked at it. You know, it's a three-way intersection. There's no leg that goes north, so that reduces the number of turning movements. And so we looked at it and said, let's look at a traffic signal, because the geometries are different than a roundabout needs. And when we evaluated a traffic signal there, we found that it works as well or better in terms of getting the amount of traffic through in a timely fashion. And so, you know, we proposed that back to the city staff and the planning commission. And, you know, that will be continued to be evaluated along with the entire transportation system that we're proposing here.
Okay. So this is at Empire or at Lowell, the traffic signal?
At Lowell, at the intersection of Silver King and Lowell.
Okay. And the National Ability Center, they thought they'd be under construction with their new mountain center now. Again, is this in the works for them to be able to do that?
Yeah, we understand the importance of the National Ability Center to the community, and their mission is just amazing what they're doing. And so, you know, everybody's interested in making sure that we can accommodate them and get them the access and the utilities that they need. And so we're working, you know, we've got some solutions proposed. And again, there's multiple parties involved to making that possible and successful. And those parties are engaged and I believe working towards a good solution there.
All right. And Robert, do you still hold an option on the property, or is it yours? Not yours, but Peg's.
No, we're under contract. So, mm-hmm. You know, we have that contract in place.
Okay, so to purchase it, if once you get approvals, is that the idea?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Hey, anything else you'd like to tell our listeners?
You know, we're very appreciative of the feedback that we received. You know, we're making adjustments as we go along, and you know, just ask folks to continue to stay engaged with us. You know, reach out, and we've conducted additional sessions with folks in the community, and we're listening, we're discussing, and you know, continue to stay engaged and come visit with us, listen to one of our presentations. Let's work together and get this done.
Okay. Robert Schmidt, Vice President of Development for Peg's Company. Thank you. Appreciate your time.
Hey, thank you, Leslie.
Well, the Park City Council met last night on the phone to recap the meeting for us. Park City Mayor Andy Bierman. Good morning, Andy.
Good morning, Leslie.
So probably the best part of the night was giving away $2.2 million that wasn't yours, federal money that came through the CARES Act. And just for full disclosure, KPCW was one of the recipients. So thank you to the decision makers for that. It looks like you had about 100 small businesses and about 30 some nonprofits. Can you tell us how this grant funding was decided?
Yeah, I'll do my best to explain it. It was actually 176 applicants, and on all they were seeking $7.4 million. About two-thirds of those applicants were businesses, and about one-third were nonprofits. And out of that, 157 received some level of funding from the grants. And the grants on the large scale were targeted towards small businesses and organizations, with a preference to those that hadn't earlier benefited from other federal funding or public funding to help with the COVID impacts. And it was essentially the council approved it in advance as part of our budget process to give out $2.2 million in the grants that we received in CARES money. And we brought in the Mountainlands Association of Governments to oversee the process. They had helped the county with their grants, and they were well equipped. And the council appointed Steve Joyce and Nan Worrell as our representatives on that group to go through the selection process. And they painstakingly went through every single application, seeing who best fits the criteria, and made the decision to allocate to these 157, which I think pretty much anybody that put in that qualified got some level of funding. And there was a little bit of discussion early on about whether we wanted to do a smaller number of grants at larger amounts or try to really spread the money around. And I think it was, as they went through those applications, it was somewhat heartbreaking seeing how hard these businesses have been hit, and the decision was made to try to help as many as possible.
Yeah, so you did look to see if these organizations or businesses had received other grant money or PPP, or part of that program?
Yeah, that was a big part of the application mm-hmm. process. They had to list any other funding they had received, and that was taken into account, both whether they received funding and how much funding they received.
Okay, so that's why we see maybe some of the restaurants here receiving $1,500 as part of the city's contribution, where another restaurant receiving $30,000, huh? Because they hadn't received anything else.
Yeah, and it seemed like most of the restaurants, because they fit the criteria, it received amounts larger than that. But yeah, if that's the case, I'm sure there were other circumstances. And having not been on that selection group, I can't tell you case by case why they picked what they did. But I am confident that they were consistent in their formula and approach.
All right. You and Councilmember Tim Henney both mentioned how frustrating it was not to be able to do more sooner to help our local businesses and nonprofits. And you talked about how communities like Park City and Moab needed to make the case that funds shouldn't only be distributed on population. How much of a challenge was it to secure this funding?
Well, it took some work, but I have to really credit my peers. Mayor Niehaus from Moab and myself are both on the board of directors for the Utah League of Cities and Towns. And as we were discussing impacts on our individual communities, economic impacts, we realized that Park City and Moab and a few other resort towns were extreme outliers in terms of the economic impacts of COVID, and that in fact many of our peer cities have seen increases in their sales tax and retail sales throughout this crisis. So we brought that up with them. We made our case. The case was pretty easy to make because they were staggered by how hard the hit was, and then they got behind a request to the state to give some additional funding based on a new formula. Because the way the formula was previously set up, it was population-based. And in a case like Park City, that means we only get credit for 8,000 people, but we host 4 million visitors a year. So it's really a misleading number. And we made that case. People were sympathetic. We went to the state. The state thought it was a good request, and we were able to receive this support, which we were really relieved to be able to get some additional money to help our businesses and nonprofits.
All right. Let's see. City Council also voted unanimously to start a master plan process to adopt a new urban park zone. Urban park districts also are designed to promote the preservation of historic buildings, sites, among other things like promoting recreation. These zones include a Rotary, Prospector, Creekside, and City Parks, as well as the municipal golf course. What advantages does this zone have over the current zone of recreation open space?
It's just it's a much greater layer of protection. If the concern was, as we become more and more space constrained, our open spaces, being our urban parks, are going to be under pressure to be made available for other uses. And this was the same debate we had over the library field. And council felt it was important we put additional protections on. So now the uses are very limited as to what can go on there. And they're basically related to parks and recreation style uses or infrastructure that's critical to support just those kind of uses. Once this zone is put over them to be able to undo those uses or change those uses, it needs to go through a very rigorous public process, which I think requires 4 or 5 public hearings, a vote of 4 out of 5 council members, and then a public referendum. So these parks, they will not be touched unless there is a darn good reason and a lot of public support for it.
A few council members mentioned how that would tie the hands of future councils, and that's usually something you want to avoid. So why did you do it in this case?
I was actually the one that brought that up. And my concern, Leslie, was that we live in a very constrained valley, and these parks are on key locations if we were to put in transportation corridors. And the public has asked us to get innovative on transportation, and we don't know what that looks like, but that could be aerial, elevated rail, some sort of techie personal pods and stuff. And if that's the case, they may need to cross these properties just because they're in the middle of some of these bottlenecks. And I ask if we wanted to make some sort of allowances for those. Staff said that there was a little bit of wiggle room on that. I had suggested maybe we strengthen that so we're more clear with the public, and council felt like they wanted to give full protections, that they didn't want to provide any additional wiggle room, and that they felt like it was critical we support these parks. So it's just a matter of competing values, and those are the tough decisions we have to make some days on council. And I think everybody believed that this was more important to the community. And, a future council may curse us, and I'll apologize in advance for that, but it's hard to look into the future. But it's pretty clear what our residents want now.
Council also voted to adopt new requirements regarding electric vehicles. The changes require dedicated parking, infrastructure, and charging stations to support electric vehicles in all new development and redevelopment projects. Councilwoman Becca Gerber brought up that although the new requirement of 20% of new off-street parking be EV vehicle friendly is a good move, she wondered if we've gone far enough. Should we go further?
I would be inclined to. I think it's a good start, and we can always add to it. You're seeing more and more pressure. California is aggressively moving towards electric vehicles. I saw that Great Britain said they were going to stop the sales of all internal combustion vehicles by 2030. And I think our president-elect has come out and said he's going to push hard for an infrastructure. And I can say, as somebody that owns an electric vehicle, that the technology is amazing. And it makes me wonder why we haven't switched sooner. So I think there's going to be pressure on the free market to expand this infrastructure. It'd be nice to get out in front of it. But I think what we chose to do last night was a good step forward, and it'll start getting some stations put in and put some new requirements in place. And if we see the needs being greater and the market being slow to respond, we can step in and push more.
Is the city charging for the electricity that's currently being consumed by electric vehicle owners?
At this point, we aren't. It's a very small amount of money that's required to charge these, in terms of we have a limited number of stations, and we're using at this point to promote electric vehicles. I think as it becomes a widespread technology, we will likely put a fee structure in place. But at this point, for us to put chargers in that require credit cards and costs and that, it was going to be more expensive than just putting free ones in. So we wanted to promote the technology. I think those parking spaces have time limits on them, so you can only get a small charge, which at best is probably a couple of bucks. And we're going to go with that for a while. But we know at some point we're going to have to refine it. But I also think the free market's going to jump in. Tim Henney brought that up last night, and I think he's absolutely right. These fast charging stations are going to come in, and they're going to replace gas stations. And that's what most people are going to use. And it's also important, one of the things we talked about is getting these charging stations into people's homes, because I think most of the use will be done at night in your own home. It'll be less as ranges become longer and longer. People aren't going to need to charge when they're running errands.
So are we going to need to get the power company involved at any point and have to upgrade all of the transformers in town to provide all of this new electricity?
That's an interesting question, and the power company actually has been very enthusiastic about this, because for them it's a new market. As we become better and better with energy conservation, our energy needs drop, but the shift to transportation essentially puts them in a position almost like an oil company, where it's a whole new area for them to sell electricity. So they have given us grants that have paid for most of this infrastructure that we put in. But what we did discover in certain places, particularly like parking lots, there isn't the existing power to run multiple chargers, and we've had to upgrade those. And upgrading those has been a slow process to get the new transformers put in. I think that's much less of an issue with residential areas where they've been built with proper capacity.
Yeah. And how big of a leap is it to convert someone's own garage to provide for an electric vehicle?
Well, it really depends house to house. If you have a dryer plug in there, something that'll work as a 240, you can convert it right away. If not, it can get fairly expensive, which is why council, one of our debates last night is whether we want to recommend or require conduit and hookups put in place for future chargers in new residential and duplexes. And council ultimately decided to require it because up front it's a small cost. I think one of the developers in town wrote us and said at best it's a couple $100 to run the conduit for future installation, where if you need to go back and cut into walls and run the conduit and expand your panels, that could be thousands of dollars and quite a deterrent.
All right. Anything else from the meeting that you wanted to mention before I move on to something else?
I did want to mention that grantees can pick up their checks today at Miners Hospital between 9 and 1. We're going to have some staff and some council members out there to greet them and hand out checks.
Wow, yeah. Champagne and balloons, too. Hey,
hey, it's something to celebrate.
Yeah. Let's see. You serve as co-chair of the host venue communities committee there for the Olympic committee. What engagement at this point is being developed with the host communities at this point? Anything?
Well, I think at this point we're getting the group set up. Their first formed was the Central Committee, the host venues communities committee that brings in essentially a regional mayor, a county council member from each of the five main regions, and then a number of athletes and a number of community leaders. And they're going to be responsible for coordinating all these communities. And then each community is forming its own host committee, and that committee is going to talk about, you know, be formed to identify and communicate each community's unique needs and wants and criteria for the Olympics. And so that will be communicated up through the Central Committee, and then the Central Committee will work with the governing board. But putting together an Olympics is complex. Luckily, we've done it before, but one of our desires is to really integrate this games with our communities. We want this to be something that's additive, that we aren't the Olympics doesn't come here and use us as a venue, but for us, it's something that highlights what our communities are about, and it integrates in our communities, and any infrastructure built is something that's going to be longstanding and stay in those communities, whether it's facilities, roads, housing, those sort of things, and support of the games. We want to make sure that those are things that we keep and use afterwards.
Yeah. So these five regional committees, I mean, are they statewide?
Well, you've got the Heber Valley, you have Park City, you have Ogden, you have the Salt Lake Valley, and the Provo area. Okay. Those are the five regions that all contain venues.
Okay. Who and so the Heber Valley then will determine their own leadership?
Well, so Mayor Mendenhall of Salt Lake and myself are the co-chairs of the Central Committee. So we were asked to reach out to regional leaders and get them started on forming these the five regional committees. Mm-hmm. And I reached out to Mayor Potter, and she will start off as the chair of the Heber Valley group. And I believe I'm not sure who she's put together yet, but there is already an existing Olympic group over there that works with a Soldier Hollow, and I think they will serve as the foundation of that regional committee.
With the influx of people coming into Park City during the pandemic, there seems to be a growing anti-development and anti-growth contingency. Do we really want to have another Games in Utah, given the fire that was lit in the state's growth after 2002?
You know, I think when the Olympics came last time, we were poised for growth. We really weren't on the map, and we were sort of an undiscovered secret and really set up to explode with growth, and I think that happened. I think second time around, we're going to use the Olympics to fortify that, what, you know, the impacts we've had from that growth. It's a good It's a good impetus to improve your transportation systems, to address some of your housing needs. It's really our goal to have a net zero games. We think we can be the first host to ever do that. So it's gonna drive us towards that 2030 goal we already have in place in Park City and Salt Lake, and give us more meaning behind that. And it's gonna be focused on the athletes. That's something that this group has been really made a priority. And if you look at all of our committees in the governing board, it's heavily represented on the athletes. So for Park City, you were there for the games. I was there. It was, to me, it was the experience of a lifetime. And I would really hate to see the next generation not get that same opportunity. And I don't think it's fair to compare it to a typical event. It really is an amazing occurrence where you get to celebrate everything that's great about your town. And I don't think it's going to promote growth in the same way the last games did. So I personally think it's a good fit, but that's a discussion the community is going to have. There are certainly doubters in the community, and there are issues that need to be addressed. What concerns me more is the general concern over events and tourism and its impacts on residents. And I think we are out of balance on that. And even though COVID has made us take a step back and maybe given us a peek into what the other side looks like, this was something we were deep in discussions prior to the pandemic hitting. And we had made a commitment through our visioning process to focus on sustainable tourism. And I hope we can really dig into that and get a better balance so things like the Olympics don't seem like a threat.
All right. So, I mean, at this point, I mean, bringing the Olympics back to Utah, is that a done deal given that... at least from the state residents' perspective? I mean, or do we need to do another survey? Because the survey that was done was done
question,
by...
Would it happen with or without our support? I think the state is very bullish on this. And a survey was done a couple of years ago, and I think it was almost 90% approval rate to bring it back. So I suppose we would probably be in an awkward position if Park City said we don't want to have the games back and the rest of the state wanted to move forward. I think that would put us in a really awkward position. My take is that most of our residents do want it back, and I'm really grateful this time around that Park City has been brought in and involved early. The fact that Park City was given a seat on the governing board for this is a real statement. The only other mayor sitting on that or local elected official period is Mayor Mendenhall of Salt Lake, which is intended to be the host city. But because Park City hosts so much of the Olympics, over 50% of the events, we made an argument that we should be represented there and part of the planning to make sure we can integrate it best with our community. And they were respectful of that. So I think thus far the bid committee has really has been very inclusive. Certainly we're going to have that talk with our community members. And if they aren't happy about the Olympics, then we're going to have a very tricky conversation, I think, on a state level about how, if they intend to move forward with games, how that would impact us.
All right, Andy, anything else you wanted to mention?
You know, just want to wish everybody a happy Thanksgiving. It's been a difficult year, but I think we can still find things to be grateful for. You know, certainly as we watch people flood to Park City and want to live here now, it reminds us how lucky we are to live here, especially during difficult times. And I just want to reiterate that the infections are soaring right now. And I beg people to please, please be careful this Thanksgiving and, you know, limit their exposure if they can, limit their Thanksgiving celebrations to just the people in their household. These holidays will be tough, but soon I think things will get back to normal. And so in the meantime, please be safe.
All right. Park City Mayor Andy Bierman, thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks, Leslie.
Earlier this month, the National Ability Center took nominations for its annual Salute Your Heroes contest. On the phone with details of those who were named, I have the NAC's Development Director, Carrie Cusimano. Good morning, Carrie.
Hi, Leslie.
How many nominations did you receive?
We had close to 50 nominations. And, oh my goodness, it was overwhelming, the response that we got from it, which is exciting. And originally we were planning on giving away two retreats to the National Ability Center, but we had a third sponsor step up, so we were able to give away three.
Okay.
So super exciting.
So who decided who won?
So the first was a first responder. His name is Eric Wagner, and he was nominated by his brother, Liam. Liam was in a terrible accident where he became paralyzed. His brother actually watched the entire thing happen, helped him through the process actually at the accident, and then over the a number of years afterwards. So the two of them, actually Liam, who nominated his brother Eric, the two of them are going to come to the National Ability Center from New York. Hopefully this winter, we'll see. They have at least a year to take advantage of coming and participating at the NAC. Obviously, there's a little bit of flexibility given all that's going on in the world right now. So Eric was the first, and then the second was Megan Lowry, who's from Oklahoma. She's a veteran herself, and she's a part of the Native American Color Guard. She also represents the Humane Society and works with service dogs, and does a lot of speaking across the country on veteran trauma, sexual trauma, and post-traumatic stress in the military. And so Megan is going to participate with us, hopefully again, this next year. And then the third was a military spouse, and the husband nominated his wife. He was basically deployed to Afghanistan and right at the height of the pandemic. And so this mother of several children was home dealing with COVID and her children and working and going to school. And the husband just wrote this beautiful story about his wife and all she had done to keep the family together during COVID and while he was deployed. And so their family is going to come out and participate with us. They're local. And so hopefully within the next, you know, so many months, we'll be able to come out and experience this. So we're really thankful for our partners, Boeing and the Dolores Story Eccles Foundation and AT&T for stepping up to sponsor these heroes in our community to come to the National Ability Center, stay overnight in our lodge, and participate in our many activities. And, you know, it's a full wellness retreat. Two nights and 3 days of activities and connection for them. So we're thrilled to be able to do this, you know, in honor of Veterans Day.
Sure. So why aren't we naming the spouse of the military service person?
They chose to be anonymous.
Okay. All right. And again, that's something you guys do every year, ask for such nominations?
No, this is the first time we did it. You know, normally we host our Saluting Our Heroes military luncheon surrounding Veterans Day, and we have over 650 people at the Grand America Hotel. And obviously it wasn't a good time to do that. It wasn't safe for anyone to come together at that level. And so we decided to pivot, and instead of hosting the luncheon, we still wanted to honor those who serve our country, be it first responders or veterans. And so we came up with this idea to shift it, and our sponsors got involved and were behind this. And then, you know, the other thing that we did in partnership with the city was the Field of Flags, where we had, you know, 150 plus flags surrounding Miners Hospital, and a lot of our partners that normally support the luncheon also supported the Field of Flags as well. So pivoting during this time, which, you know, that's what the National Ability Center does. We adapt and we do it well. So we're excited about the contest. I think we'll probably continue it because it was so well received. While it was something that we did in a, you know, in a time of COVID, I think it was so well received that we'll continue to do it in future years.
Okay. Anything else you want to add?
No, well, it's an exciting time. Obviously, the Park City Mountain's opening this weekend, and so our registration is opening for a ski and snowboard program this upcoming Monday. So excited to get our many participants signed up for lessons this winter. And obviously, we have all of our guidelines and social distancing and sanitation requirements in place so that we keep all of our participants, staff, and volunteers safe during the ski season. And so we're just excited to get that launched.
Okay. Carrie, thanks for checking in. Thank you.
Of course. Thanks, Leslie. Bye-bye.
Carrie Cusimano, again, Development Director with the NAC. You're listening to the Local News Hour. A handful of cars were towed on Guardsman's Pass during last weekend's snowstorm after snowplows were apparently blocked from accessing the road. KPCW's Sean Higgins reports on the importance of proper winter trail access parking.
Trail access issues in Park City are not a new topic. An explosion in the popularity of trails in and around Park City in recent years has led to a number of problems like crowded trailheads, trespassing, and increased noise and parking problems. This past weekend, dozens of cars were parked on Guardsman Pass above Park City, and a handful were towed after a snowplow was not able to get through and access the road. Park City Trails and Open Space Program Manager Heinrich Dieters says there are over two dozen parking spots for trail access on Guardsman Pass above the roundabout at the Montage. He says the plowing in that area is actually done by the Talisker Club, not the city, and trail users need to be mindful of plowing needs as the snow continues to fall in Park City.
There's 25 spots there, obviously depending on the winter and the plowing, you know, that can obviously be minimized. You know, when we have a big snow year, I know that road gets very skinny and congested, you know, especially with the plowing, and the plowing is very important in that area. Talisker provides plowing in that and that stretch of Marsac, if you will. It's basically Guardsman and Marsac. It's really something to plan ahead. And then, you know, if you're going someplace, you know, park in the designated trailhead areas. And you know, that would be a suggestion by myself.
He adds, as Upper Guardsman Pass closes to traffic in the winter, planning ahead becomes even more important. Parking enforcement at various trailheads in the greater Snyderville Basin actually began earlier this summer in an effort to clamp down on trail users parking in residential areas instead of designated trailhead parking. One of the main justifications given by Summit County for the increased enforcement was that crowded street parking would not allow enough room for emergency vehicles and snow clearing equipment to access the street, which is exactly what happened on Guardsman Pass last weekend. In response, Dieters and his counterparts in Wasatch County, the Mountain Trails Foundation, and Basin Recreation will soon be releasing information on preferred winter trail access. Dieters says the more information available to winter trail users, the more ticketing and towing of cars can be avoided.
So I think what the best bet for people is to really sort of plan ahead. You know, the new Wasatch County Trails Manager, Charlie with Mountain Trails, Matt with the Basin, and myself, we're working right now on a winter trails, like suggested access areas. And so it's probably some areas that, you know, have the appropriate parking, they have facilities associated with it. And we're sort of encouraging people to go to those areas.
The preferred winter trail access information is expected to be released sometime next week. Sean Higgins, KPCW News.